just a couple of stories about amends that when I got sober, I had been living in, actually not far from Don, I'd been living just outside of Tacoma. I was living in a place called Bremerton, and I was driving through Tacoma while I was drinking one time, and I was sober at the time I was driving, but I didn't have a driver's license. And they take that seriously up there. I got pulled over, and I got a ticket for driving on a suspended license. Now, I never checked out what that fine was, and I don't know if the story I'm about to tell you is true or not, but while I was getting loaded and getting drunk with a couple of guys afterwards later on that day, they told me a story that I assumed was true. And they told me that there'd been a crackdown on that in that county, and that if you got arrested first offense for driving on a suspended license, you had to do 9 months in jail. There was no way around it. Now, I never asked anybody at the court if that was true. Why would you? I got my drunken buddies telling me a story. They all agreed with each other, so I assumed it was true. So I did the only thing that I could do. I moved. I moved to New Jersey, and this is back before computers were connecting every different state and county. I moved to New Jersey, got a New Jersey driver's license, moved from New Jersey back to Southern California, used my New Jersey driver's license to get my California driver's license. I got a driver's license. I moved to Nevada. I have my California driver's license. I get a Nevada driver's license. The fact that I had a suspended license at some point in the past and gotten in trouble for driving on it in Tacoma meant nothing to me. It meant nothing to me. But I'm telling my sponsor about this stuff because, oh, you should probably clean that up. And as I get sober and I'm driving around in Nevada, I start noticing cops. And I'm just sure that I know what's going to happen. I'm going to get pulled over. Now, computers are getting more prevalent. I'm hearing stories of guys that have got warrants in different states that now everything's connected. And I know what's going to happen. I'm going to be sober a year, 2 years sober driving along. I'm going to get pulled over, get hauled out of the car. I'm going to get transported up to Tacoma, and it's going to be on the local AA club newsletter that Sheldon just went to jail sober for driving on a suspended license, and it's starting to make me crazy, and I'm starting to think I need to make this amends. But there's a caveat to the amends. It says except when to do so would injure them or others. So I have this conversation with my wife about how I think I'm going to have to go to jail in Tacoma. And I don't want to go, but I think I'm going to have to. I got to clean this up. Unless, of course, it would be a great hardship for you. If it would injure you terribly, I will suffer and not go. And she says, well, you know you already know this, honey. When I left Florida to move to Las Vegas where we met, I had had a DUI not long before I left Florida. And I got that hanging over my head. And I don't mind if you go to Tacoma and take care of your stuff, but I'm going to have to go to Florida. And it's my third one. I'm probably going to do a year. If you're okay with the hardship that'll cause you, I'm okay. I said, well, no, I can't live without you for a year. I will not give you permission to go to Florida. Absolutely not. And she said, well, I will not give you permission to go to Tacoma. And so for the next couple of years, we just had this pact. Where I would not let her go to Florida as much as she said she wanted to, and she would not let me go to Tacoma as much as I begged. But it got to me, and it got to me more and more, and I called my sponsor, and I told him, and he said, why don't you do this? Why? This is back in the days of payphones. He said, why don't you go to a payphone where they won't know who you are or where you're calling from? And call up Tacoma and tell them about this ticket and ask them what you're really facing. What would it really be? Because I'm still going based on the two drunken wannabe attorneys from my couch. Right? I have no idea what I'm facing. I call them up, I give them my name, ask for wants and warrants. And it turns out that when the cop entered that ticket, he entered it incorrectly. And I did not have driving on a suspended driver's license. I had driving on expired registration, which is not the crime that I committed, but that's the way they entered it in the computer. It was a $93 fine. So I called my sponsor. She says, well, call him back and give him your name again and just have him be certain that there isn't two tickets. I called him back. And they told me, absolutely, the only thing you have is you owe us $93 for driving on a suspended registration. So I went home and I told my wife, I have good news and bad news. She said, what's the good news? The good news is that I can clean up my stuff in Tacoma. It's going to cost us $93. Bad news is you're going to Florida. And at 5 years sober, my wife sat in DUI classes in Las Vegas to clear that up. So that's a... On a more serious note, I have two other amends that I had to make that I want to share with you. One of them was to my mom. You know, I told you guys about the difficult relationship my mom and I had in my childhood and the separation and the distance between us. And I get sober. And the first year or so that I was sober, I would talk to her every week on the phone. We didn't really see much of each other. She lived in Chicago at the time, and her husband was in the steel castings business, and there's an exhibition in Vegas that he had to come to. My mom came along with him. She figured I can see him and visit him and, you know, check on my son, but if he's full of crap like you think he probably is, at least I'll be with my husband at this exhibition and it'll be a trip to Vegas. Well, she comes out and I'm gonna make amends to her. And my sponsor has always told me this story about with his folks, where when he made amends, his dad let him off the hook for the money he owed him. And his sponsor said to him, that doesn't matter. You need to find a way to pay the money back. Your dad can't forgive the debt you owe, you gotta pay. And so I get to dinner with my mom and my stepdad, and I explain to my mom about this motorcycle that had been in her name that I had crashed, and I left the country, and she still had to make those payments, and my mom never had any money, and it was a big hardship for her. And I'd been in her wallet, and I'd stolen money over the years from her. And the way I figured it, I owed her several thousand dollars, and I wanted to find a way to pay it back. And I didn't have a lot of money, but I'd like to make payments. And she says, no, 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 honey, you don't owe me the money. And I, listen, I had the story from my sponsor. I said, Mom, you don't understand. You got to have a way for me to pay this back. And she said, no, you really don't owe me the money. Your aunt died. And she left you and your brother and your stepbrother a pile of money each. And they gave your brother and your stepbrother theirs. And I kept yours because you owed it to me. I wasn't mad. I'm like, good, because I can't afford these payments and that debt's been paid. I never did mention that to my sponsor. I just thought it was great that I'm off the hook. Fast forward a little bit, I meet my wife, we get married, and my wife is a real family-oriented person. She talks to her mom every day for an hour on the phone, which I can't imagine what you would say to somebody every day for 5 minutes on the phone, but she talks to her mom every day for an hour on the phone. And my mom's going to be her mother-in-law. She wants to talk to my mom. I tell her it's not a good idea. I talk to my mom once a week. I call my mom once a week because I want to be a good AA guy. That's what good AA guys do. I call my mom every Sunday. Every Sunday at 1 o'clock, I call my mom about a 5-minute phone call. I say, hey, Mom, how are you? She says, I'm fine, good. Are you fine? I'm fine, fine. You're fine? I'm fine, fine. We're fine, fine. Talk to you next Sunday, fine. Because when I see my mom and I talk to my mom, she's this 9-foot giant that judges me and has opinions and wants to tell me how I should behave, and it's cold, and I love my mom theoretically, right? In theory, I love my mom. But in reality, there's no connection. And she intimidates me. And I'm not, but I call her at fine. I'm fine. You're fine, 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 fine. Well, this one time I call her and I go, hi, Mom, how are you? She goes, fine, good, you're fine, fine. Yeah, I'm fine, you're fine, fine. Everything's fine, fine. And before I could say goodbye, she goes, how's that thing going at work? I go, what thing? Well, how do you know about it? Oh, well, I was talking to Jackie. I go running downstairs. Don't talk to her. What are you doing? Now they're getting close. They're like becoming friends, right? My wife is making friends with the enemy. Then we have a son. And there's me and my brother, my stepbrother, and I'm the only one, I have the only grandchild. So when my mom and my stepdad retired, they could have gone anywhere in the world, but they chose to come to Vegas because they wanted to be near their only grandson. They didn't want to be near me, right? No delusion there, but at least I'd made enough effort to where I didn't make it feel like they couldn't. There was enough of a repaired connection where they were able to come to Vegas, but my mom wanted to be near her grandson. So now she's coming to the house, right? And I don't want to be this way. I don't want to be this way. But when I hear her knock on the door, you have to understand, my mom she's 4'9½". Right? She's a little frame of a woman. She knocks on the door. It sounds like, right? It's like frightening. Boom, boom, boom. I open the door, she comes out. It's a shadow of a woman. I'm just on guard all the time. I just feel like I have to watch every word I say. Everything has to be carefully thought out because she's going to have an opinion and a judgment and something to say, and I'm going to get that look. You know the look. You've all seen the look. I was sitting in the living room one day, and this has been going on for a couple of years. And I am so grateful that I was sober a while when this happened so I could have the vision of it for what it was. Because had this happened earlier in my sobriety, I never would have gotten the gift I was about to get. This is probably in 2004. I was probably about 8 years sober. And my mom and my stepdad and my wife and I are sitting in the living room, and my mom starts to talk about how she has car problems. Now, I'm in the car business. Cars are easy for me. At this point in my life, I'm making more money than I've ever made. I could afford to help my mom with a car. So I say to my mom, Mom, let's do this. Let me help you get a car. She says to me, my own mother, no, that's okay, honey. I don't want your charity. This is more evidence for what my mom is like. Referring to me trying to do something magnanimous as charity, right? I take a deep breath and I say to her what I think is a lie. I think it's a lie. I think I'm making a joke. I say, Mom, you know there was that motorcycle that I wrecked and that money I took. I never really did make amends for that stuff. Why don't you let me really make amends? It won't be charity. We'll call it me leveling the field. My stepdad, who is Scottish, and if you know anything about the Scots, they make the Jews look like the most generous people on the planet. So my stepdad says, it's a free car, for God's sakes. Take the car. It's free. He said free, for God's sakes. I swear to God. It's free! So I trade her a car in, get her a little car, nothing fancy. I'm making payments on the car, no big deal. I couldn't have missed the money if I'd tried. $200 payment every month. Would have been impossible for me to miss the money with where I was at financially at that stage of my life. But I tell you, something miraculous happened. Something that is hard to explain, but very clear when experienced. See, I owed my mom, and I knew I owed my mom. And in order for my ego to be okay with me owing my mom, my ego had to rewrite history, had to change the past to turn my mom into the kind of person it would be okay to owe. It had to create a story about her that wasn't true. It had grains of truth, but it wasn't true. It had to turn her into a monster. I had to have a story in my head that if I got to sit with you one-on-one and tell you about my mom, you would say, oh, it's okay that you screwed her out of that money. She kind of deserves it. I had to write that story. I had to write that story for it to be okay for me to owe. And when I started to pay, and the payment started to be made, and I started to feel even with my mom. I no longer needed the story to make it okay for me to owe. And my mom started to change in front of my eyes. And what my mom turned into is a woman that in a difficult situation did the very best she could. A woman that sacrificed the best years of her life. A woman that worked two jobs and she walked to work in the snow. She was 40 years old when we got our first family car. I was 15 when we got our first car. We didn't have a car as kids. She had to walk everywhere. She cleaned houses of the girls that she used to go to high school with. She went without. I never even really knew how poor we were. I always had new clothes and new toys and new stuff. She was buying her own clothes out of secondhand stores. She'd date a guy and he'd raise his voice or be disrespectful to me and my brother, and she'd kick him out the house. She sacrificed everything for me and him. And I wrote a story to defend myself from owing her a couple of $1,000. I wrote a story and changed history to make it okay to owe. It's true what Don says, that we make amends to the people in our family because we owe them, and they deserve the dignity of hearing that we're sorry. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, what about the person that we hate? In that case, we take the bit in our teeth because we find it more beneficial to us. My ego will defend its right. My ego will tell me stories about me that I have no defense against. It will say, Sheldon, you're a piece of crap. You don't deserve nothing. Of course, nobody likes you. You're worthless. You're a scumbag. You're a dirtbag. You're a liar. You're a cheat, and you're a thief. You don't deserve God's grace. You don't deserve his love. You don't deserve anybody's love. You don't deserve opportunities. You don't deserve advancement. You don't deserve happiness. And unless I feed my spirit something to say in reply, it will be the only voice that rattles inside my head. But when I start to do esteemable things and I start to clear up the wreckage, my spirit gets to say, wait a minute, you fixed that with your mom. Yeah, you made some mistakes, but you're a good guy. You did the best you could to turn that around. You got her that car, remember? You told her you were sorry. You hugged her and you cried. You're not that bad of a guy. In the absence of the good deeds that I can do in this world, the large piece of it being the amends, when the ego tears me down, the spirit has no response. Think about the people that you're angry at and ask yourself, what do you owe? You know, Don's talking about the IRS. Next time you're at a meeting and someone's going on and on about how much they hate the IRS, ask them how much they owe. I guarantee there's a dollar amount. All right, I guarantee it. 2008, the world went mad. We all lost houses and we hated the banks as if it was their fault. Wasn't their fault when they lent us the money, boy. We were eager for the dough then. So what happens is when I owe, I create stories about the people that I owe to justify that it's okay that I owe. And when I start to level the playing field, the anger and the fear and the resentment start to go. You know, this 180-degree turn that we talk about in step four begins in step four, but it ends in step nine. This old-timer John, the same guy that told me about treading water in Lake Mead, said to me, Sheldon, you're going to buy your self-respect, your dignity, and your self-esteem back the very same way you spent it, one nickel and one dime at a time. And God bless you on that journey. I'm going to tell you one very quick story, and we'll take a break. While I was up in Bremen at that time, I lived in a little A-frame house that I was renting. I was a national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances, had plenty of money, rented a cute little A-frame. Problem was I would get paid once a month in the middle of the month, and while I would drink and snort all the money, and I wouldn't last till rent day. Rent was due on the 5th, I got paid on the 15th. I was always broke on the 5th, so I was always late on the rent on this place. And it was pathetic because I could easily have afforded it. But I fell 2 months behind on the rent. And I get to this point where I get this ticket now for this driving without a license, and I'm moving to New Jersey to be closer to the company. So I call the landlord and I invite him over and I tell him, I'm really sorry I got to move. And I don't have your 2 months rent. And this guy gets a look of horror on his face. And he says, Sheldon, I've lived here for 20 years. The place is almost paid off, but not yet. I have a mortgage on it. I met a girl, I moved in with her. We're hoping to pay this off, and it'll be our retirement. I don't have the money to catch up the mortgage. You have to pay me. I'm going to lose this place if I don't get the payments to pay the mortgage. And I tell him, well, I don't have the money. I'm terribly sorry. You're on your own, pal. What do I care? It's your problem, and I leave. And I get sober, and I realize that I've probably stolen this guy's retirement from him. I had no way to pay him. I don't know if he lost the place. I don't know what happened. I'm calculating my amends, and if I cost this guy this, what do I owe him, a couple hundred grand? I don't even know where to begin. I start doing pretty well, and I'm not willing to make the amends. It's going to be too much money. There's no way I can make the amends. It's impossible. But I start doing better and better. Now I got a little bit of rental property that I've acquired, and people are late on the rent on that rental property, and I know it's because the universe is paying me back for what I did to this guy Don with his A-frame up in Bremerton, and I know that. And I just can't live with myself anymore, and I go to my sponsor and I say, look, I don't know what to do. I think I owe this guy $250,000 or something, whatever that A-frame is worth. He goes, well, how much did you stip him for? It was about $2,500. But he told me that the place was getting foreclosed on and that I'd cost him his place. And Bob says, well, maybe you don't really owe him that much, but why don't you call him up and talk to him? And so now I got to find the guy. And the only way I know how to find the guy is I spend money into a background check on myself to find my address in Bremerton that I do, because I don't know how to get hold of the guy. So I find my address, and then I do property search to see who owns the address at those dates. Then I do a background check on the guy that owned the place. And this is like a six-month journey, and eventually I find the guy, and I call him up, and I say, hi, is this Don? He says, yeah, it's Don. I go, hi, Don, it's Sheldon Fede. I don't know if you remember me. And he says, oh, I remember you. Well, now the blood in my veins is ice cold because I know what's coming. You're the guy that cost me my... I'm living in a homeless shelter, but... I said, well, if you remember, I was living at your place, and I think I'm the guy that caused you to get that property foreclosed on, and I don't know what your retirement looks like, and I'm so sorry for the damage I caused you. I want to make it right. And he starts laughing. He goes, hell, I've been telling that story to people for the last 25 years. Anytime anybody's late on the rent, I lay them on the foreclosure story. I figure if you're going to stiff me, you're going to suffer a little bit of embarrassment and uncomfortability along the way. And if you got a conscience, maybe a little guilt. Because I still own that damn property. What do I owe you? And he says, hold on a minute. And he goes to sounds like a drawer in a file, and he pulls out a piece of paper. He goes, $1,937.22. Well, I'd like to send you that. He goes, well, we'll see if you do, kid. Nobody ever has paid me, but here's my new address, blah, blah, blah. And I send him $2,500, a little bit of interest on top and for hassle. I had been tortured by a story I had told myself. I think I was 15 years sober at this point. Telling my wife when people didn't pay, it's my fault they didn't pay the rent on the rental property, honey. I screwed this guy up in Bremerton. I get a letter from him, and it was the nicest letter. I kept the letter. I still have the letter at home. He told me that he'd owned various rental properties all throughout his life, and that many people had stiffed him, and he wasn't mad at anybody. He understood these things happen, but nobody had ever sent him the money back, and he was glad to hear I was sober in AA. And if he ever knew anybody that needed help with a drug or alcohol problem, he knew where to send them, because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous had done amazing work in my life. And he was proud to see that I'd become a good member of society. And he was glad to know that Alcoholics Anonymous works. We don't know. When Don talks about the stones we drop in the water and the ripples of negativity, we drop bigger stones in that same water in Alcoholics Anonymous when we're sober. And the positive ripples that follow are bigger and more powerful. Let's take a break. Back in 10 minutes.